Christine Sherry is our first speaker. Christine Sherry teaches philanthropy at Stanford and has been in the field for, I believe, over 30 years, correct? Excellent. Here you go, Sherry.
Thank you so much. So I have 5 minutes to give you guys 10 rules of thumb about how to be impactful in your philanthropy. It feels a little bit like trying to do the abridged works of Shakespeare in 5 minutes, but I'm going to give it a go, except for we've just lost the slides. Okay, great. So, are you auto-forwarding? Yeah? It does. Okay, good. Okay, great. Okay, so rule number one, obviously, know what you bring to the party. I mean, people here are smart. You guys are well-educated. You have your professional experience, but you also have other assets. You have your personal networks. You have your professional networks. You have areas of expertise. You have communities that you know. This is what I bring to the party. I was the founder of the Philanthropy Workshop. I ran the Plowshares Fund in the beginning. I was at the Hewlett Foundation for a decade. I teach at Stanford. I've been in this game a long time, but I know also what I don't know. So what do? You scan the field to learn from others. Field scans are a hugely underutilized resource in this field. I think it's really essential to go out and find what has been written. I worked in institutional philanthropy where hundreds of scans are done every year. Our firm does them. We publish them. We believe in transparency. This was a scan looking at the issue of climate change and national security, a topic that President Obama talked about not long ago. Scans are critical to understand the history of it. Rule number three, learn from history. This is J.D. Rockefeller, founder of scientific philanthropy, which is a precursor to what you guys are all talking about. There's been a tremendous amount of research that's been done that is now really available in the field. So I'd say learn from history and learn from studies. Let's talk quickly about a case study, microfinance. Microfinance was considered to be the silver bullet back in 2000. Some of you guys are smiling. You know, people said microloans are going to eradicate poverty, not just in our lifetime, but maybe in the next 4 or 5 years. Well, the data actually showed, even back then, that the studies were inconclusive and contradictory. Yes, maybe microloans could provide income smoothing, maybe they could improve women's social status, but rarely did they target the poorest of the poor. And in certain instances, they actually did harm. This is a screenshot of a story from the Wall Street Journal just a few months ago, but it's really showing what the evidence showed well over a decade ago. So I say it's really critical to go out and look at studies and look at the field and learn from history. And that leads me to rule number four, which is do no harm. We don't talk about that a lot in this space, but it's really essential and it's really critical to examine the interventions you're talking about and think about the risks of harm, which are not inconsiderable in a number of different interventions. Which then I think leads to my rule number five, which is beware the shiny new object. Philanthropy tends to embrace certain ideas with a great deal of vogue. I'm sure there are some that you all are thinking about here, and it's really essential that you bring that level of historical accuracy and skepticism. Rule number six, question some of your orthodoxies. I did a study for Wendy and the Schmidt Foundation looking at issues around violence against women in the Congo. The orthodoxy was, let's stop mining, let's find more opportunities to house women who've been the subject of rape. But in fact, there were many other strategies that were much more essential, including those in advocacy. Advocacy is something that's really difficult to measure. You can't do randomized control trials about it, but I think the history of philanthropy shows us that advocacy is an essential and critical tool. So let's look at an example. Many of you are interested in disaster relief. We also know that billions of dollars have gone into places like Haiti with minimal effect, but some of the most interesting and respected strategies have been around building the capacity of Haitians to rebuild their own community and bring some level of governance to the question. That leads me to rule number eight, which is that context matters. It's not like there is a single intervention that's going to work in every country or every region. We know that. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been funding a whole lot in family planning, very, very excellent work up on their website that talks about, for example, Ethiopia as an emerging success story. But we also know if you look at two countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan, these are two countries when they separated had essentially the same fertility rates. Bangladesh incorporated some really robust community-based family planning strategies, whereas Pakistan didn't. And that many years later, we have dramatically different results. Leading me to rule number nine, which is that patience matters. This is a long game. This is a really long game. 6 weeks ago, the United States Supreme Court came out with a marriage equality decision, probably one of the seminal civil rights decisions of probably the last two or three decades. It didn't just happen. It came from funders like the Evelyn Walter Haas Jr. Fund, funding the movement of marriage equality, along with many, many others, very consistently for a very long period of time, and being willing to stay the course when there were a number of setbacks. So my last rule, rule number 10, get out there and see it for yourself. Everything that I've learned about philanthropy, I've learned by being in the field and asking questions and getting uncomfortable and listening to people. And yes, we bring our intellect and our rigorous thinking to the table, but we really need to understand and feel and touch it and learn and see that these problems are deep and complex and intractable. It will bring you humility, and it will make you so much more effective as altruists. Thank you.
So we shall continue. So Dmitry Kaminsky, did I say your name correctly? Okay. And Dmitry is with the Biogerontology Research Foundation.
Yes. Hello. I'm trustee of Biogerontology Research Foundation. It's the UK-based anti-aging think tank. And also, I'm venture investor. We are focused on AI and genetics, and especially their intersections. But personally, I'm sure that the most ultimate evil is aging. And that's why the best way for effective altruism is to support aging research and to invest in companies which have practical applications in the sphere. And now I want to introduce you to my colleague, Arik Zhavornikov, Dr. Arik Zhavornikov.
Actually, thank you, Dmitry. And so Dmitry is a very wealthy man operating a venture fund out of Hong Kong. You might think that investing in aging is a very egocentric thing. And you might think that it's also not a very urgent cause because you'll be able to tackle it sometime later. So Dmitry invited me to speak on his behalf here a little bit to show you how to convince the general public and yourself that aging is a very pressing cause. So it's, of course, ultimate evil. Nobody can say that they are saving lives today because they're essentially marginally extending them. Lives are too short to save. And what is a life? So I'll show you why it's important to address aging first and increase productive longevity before any other cause. Because otherwise, if we don't do it quickly, all other causes will be destroyed. All your work is going to be destroyed because of the possible economic collapse and degradation of the economic systems. So on this slide, you see the history of humanity. So that curve is population. That small curve is population over 65. So it took us at the last 600 years of human evolution, it took us 400 years for the population to double from half a billion to a billion. It took us another 160 years for it to double from a billion to 2 billion. And then within 60 years, we went to 7 billion. And most of the biomedical advances also happened in that time frame. So they are happening. A lot of biomedical advances that will extend your life has already happened. And if you think at biomedical publications, they are exponential. Now funding has also become exponential. So more than $1 trillion has been spent on biomedical research over the past 25 years that will yield some longevity dividend. So we will be living longer. But will we live healthier? Well, Michael just was talked about the director of the NIH. Most of this funding that the NIH is spending and most of the funding that the pharma companies are spending is spent to extend lifespan marginally, essentially extend the last years of life of a terminally ill patient. That needs to change because otherwise our social security and healthcare system is going to collapse. I mean, those are very conservative projections from CDC in 2003 showing how the U.S. demography is going to change. So this slice on the top is population over 65. And that's probably quite conservative. That's going to increase even further by 2030. So there is a problem of intergenerational theft and the sandwich generation. So basically, The working population is being squeezed from one side by their children, on the other side by the retirees, and that portion of the population is quickly expanding. So we did some analysis as a hobby. We basically replicated Lawrence Kotlikoff's work on taking the net present value of future unfunded liabilities and showed that even if life expectancy doesn't change, right now the U.S. economy basically owes its citizens more than $60 trillion in net present value, and $17 trillion being the national debt. So the unseen part of the iceberg is Social Security and healthcare. And if you move, if you increase lifespan by at least four years, this figure becomes $300 trillion. So it's a very sensitive system. Once governments of the other developed countries recognize this problem, yes, the U.S. dollar may actually depreciate, and that will take the life out of the global economy, and all the other causes are going to come to nil. So right now we might see two scenarios. One scenario where we invest in aging research and accelerate global growth, where rejuvenation rate in the population will outpace the non-rejuvenating biomedical progress rate, or we might actually collapse as the economy. So investing in aging research, that's the most altruistic cause, as a matter of fact. So by helping yourself, you're also going to help the developed world, because if you keep the developing countries on a sustainable level, they will export wealth into developing countries as well. What we need to do right now, and everyone can contribute, and it doesn't take much to do this, is we need to classify aging as a disease. We need to accelerate aging research and essentially refocus funding. So if we're looking at the NIH and basically U.S. government funding, and the U.S. government is the beating heart of research, or used to be the beating heart of research in the world. I mean, now China is doing quite well as well. We need to refocus research activities from last mile treatment to prevention and start treating aging as a disease. So thank you very much, and please join this cause.
Thank you, and spasiba. All right, thank you so much. And next we have Patrick LaVictoire with Miri. Is that correct? Okay.
Hi, I'm Patrick LaVictoire. I work at the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. I'm a mathematician, and I'd like to talk about why and how we do what we do. And since this is an EA Global Ignite talk, I would like to start by talking about a very relevant topic here. Waiting for 15 seconds. Global ignition. So in 1945, the Trinity nuclear test, before it actually went off, they had Hans Bethe run the calculations to just check whether the first nuclear explosion would actually ignite the atmosphere and destroy all life on Earth. I think we might agree that this was a very good calculation for somebody to run. Then the question then is, what similar things might we do with something as big as artificial intelligence? So imagine that it's 50 or 60 years in the future. Oh, by the way, I have some slides that are duplicates. So imagine it's 50, 60 years in the future. Imagine that we're at the time of artificial intelligence at about the human level or beyond. What could possibly go wrong? What are you worried about? And what safety topics do you think you might want to research in advance? That is Miri's technical agenda. Now, when most people hear about Miri's work on AI safety, they immediately think of one thing and one thing only, the Terminator malevolent AI. That's not actually what the danger is. It's not that AI will be secretly evil. We're instead worried about a much more insidious and dangerous thing that could happen with intelligent AI, creativity. I expected somebody to laugh at that. So the problem is, if an artificial intelligence solves a problem that you said it, but not in the way that you meant it, then it thinks it solved the problem, right? It thinks this is a great solution. You could have a hedge fund that employs an artificial intelligence that crashes the stock market in order to make the division by zero error, so it has an infinite stock price. Thinks, great, I've solved this problem. It's even worse when you can reshape the entire environment. And things get even dicier when you have self-modification, self-reflection, all kinds of things that only happen at certain levels of artificial intelligence capability. So if you're worried about things that could possibly go wrong, you want to worry about things where they don't have all of our values, or things where they originally did, but then they changed themselves, or things where they're making bad decisions because there is some sort of self-referential Escher-like loop. So this is the kind of problem that MIRI is focused on, and the stakes are literally universal. This is the Hubble Deep Field. This is, as Nick Bostrom mentioned this morning, just how much value there is to capitalize, and we don't want to waste it because we didn't think about doing safety in advance. So how do we make the on button more safe? Actually, this is going to laugh too. So the kind of questions you want are critical for artificial intelligence safety, are things we could tractably model today, and things that aren't going to be addressed by the normal safety mechanisms because they only show up at sufficiently advanced levels of artificial intelligence. For instance, you could have the problem of value learning. So I said before, what happens when you have an artificial intelligence that has a simple goal, but it fulfills it in a way that wasn't what you meant? You want to actually solve that problem before you have an artificial intelligence that can actually come up with creative solutions that human beings couldn't even think of for reshaping the environment or ourselves. I also mentioned the problem of artificial intelligences that will want to change themselves and self-modify. You want to make sure that they do so in a stable way that preserves the goals that they care about, so long as you get the goal right initially. You could also have problems that come up with reflection in an artificial intelligence system. There are some problems of decision theory that come up precisely when it's able to predict what it's going to decide in advance and get weird self-fulfilling prophecies out of that. This is too complicated to explain in 15 seconds. And then there's the question, you want to be able to get these questions mostly right and have that be good enough, rather than one mistake being oops for humanity. So, and you don't want the artificial intelligence to try and hold on to its own goals if you want to change them. So this is the research agenda of MIRI in extremely, extremely brief sense. We have, we're turning philosophical problems into mathematical models, which eventually hope to turn into engineering. I compare this like cryptography. We turn cryptography from an algorithm into an engineering practice. For more resources, MIRI's website, intelligence.org, is great. Matt Falshaw made it. Superintelligence by Nick Bostrom is fantastic. Delve into these issues. MIRI's put up technical agenda papers where they talk with actual math on the things that we're trying to engineer, and you can email me or talk to me after this with any questions you have. I am really happy to explain anything about MIRI. So thank you very much.
Would you like to next we have Diego Caliero. Is he Caliero? Caliero. Okay. And are you with Singularity Institute?
No.
Never mind, I found, there you go.
Okay, so let's talk about four things that clearly go along together. Attractors, morality, barter, and Neptune. Attractors are just what they seem. They compel matter towards them. And so far in the history of the universe, in the parts that matter to us, there have been four main types of attractors. Gravity, food, sexual selection, and more recently, the economy, or money. What I want to talk to you about is a conceptual framework for a fifth attractor. And that would be the attractor of morality, which I will use to convey the concepts of moral economics. So, as we see now, we're compelled to save that child. Or if you're into astronomical stakes, you might be compelled to prevent every single drop in those oceans a billion years from now. From being tears of sadness as opposed to the possible tears of joy that could have arisen. But the current state of morality in the movement is primitive in relation to the state of present-day economics. We have one, as of yet, unpublished paper by Toby Ard on moral trade, and this is pretty much the state of affairs when you think about how to connect morality to economics at the moment. Furthermore, the public thinks that morality is an attractor going in one direction, whereas money is going in the reverse direction. So given those two things, I would say that the current state of thinking about morality and economics together is a very primitive one. We're still in a trade and barter stage equivalent for moral economics. And what's interesting, though, about Neptune? What is interesting about Neptune is how it was found. So Neptune was not seen like the other planets in the solar system. Neptune was predicted by as understanding a gravitational pull that organizes the orbit of the planet Uranus. And it had some variations which caused us to infer that there would be a place. So we had an idea of where to look at. And that idea led us to the discovery of Neptune. So Morrow economics is a similar type of idea. And what I want to convey with it is that we should try to build a road to the Neptune equivalence in economics. So what is the status quo? You have an idea that is both morality related and economics related. What do you do with it? You post it in the Effective Altruism Forum. That happens to certificates of impact, altruistic arbitrage. It could happen to a moral market app. But this is kind of like running on epicycles. That's the equivalent. And what I would like to see is like actually having an attractive space for this concept, which will allow us to find the hidden Neptunes, the hidden concepts that are nearby and involved in that. So this is exactly what happened. So we posted about moral economics in the EA forum by presenting some of the paradigmatic cases of moral economic concepts. And what ended up happening is that almost instantly, many people came to me with ideas for how to go about creating other concepts that are in the same space, that are like the Neptune equivalents of concepts that could be used in this moral network type, in this moral economics aspect. Okay, so once again, the idea, the basic idea of moral economics is to create a place where you can look for the attractors in order to take concepts from the economic space and plaster them into like altruistic exchange, moral trade, and see which are the similarities and the differences that operate there. So these four attractors, 1 minute? Okay, yeah. These four attractors that have governed us so far, given this idea of how to think about the long vision of moral economics. And it would be like a fifth attractor. And the way I think about this is kind of as a dual star system where you have most of the input and output in economics being produced by the major star. And you have another star, like the taking and funneling a lot of the resources into this other system, which is maximally efficient, superfluid, economically oriented, and altruistic. And this dual star system is the attractor that I would like to create and that I would like people to envision when they have this concept and create these new ideas. Okay, so what is my role here? We are currently in this very primitive stage of moral barter and moral trade. And what I'm trying to do is to pull this exponential curve upwards so as to increase the derivative so we can get much more quickly from the barter trade stage in which the moral trade paper has been set so far, all the way up to actually having a fluid economic system which organizes things also when you're doing moral trade, when you're doing altruistic exchange, and those sorts of things. Those are kind of galactic aspirations for the people who will end up following into moral economics. And I think that galactic aspirations are interesting, but for as most effective altruists here know, galactic aspirations are kind of insufficient from the EA perspective. So what I would like to see next year is for someone else to come here on stage to talk about moral economics and give us an idea of how to outsource these concepts into our extended mind and kind of take those algorithms and implement them in a way that they're so integrated with our cognitive unconscious that you're actually doing moral trade and making exchanges that are altruistic and that are valuable in those ways without even thinking about it. I want this to be like an ingrained part of the system. That's it. That's what I got. Thank you.
And next up we have Paul Dwan. Is it Dwan? Okay. And he works with a group that facilitates collaboration on EA projects. Is that correct? No, never mind. He does not do that. Forget. That is one of his slides. So now you know some of his content.
Cool. Hi, everyone. So as you've seen today and yesterday at the EA Global Conference, there are many, many very different ideas and currents within effective altruism. And so kind of the big question here is, what sense do we make of all this mess, right? Like when it comes to selecting a project or starting a new organization, which models do you choose among all these competing models that exist here? One thing you can say is, well, you know, maybe we disagree on what's the most effective, but at the end of the day, we are all effective altruists, and it's about maximizing impact, so it's fine. But that's kind of the easy way out. And what I think is important is also to create some kind of framework that allows us to reason about all these different methods in a way that is consistent with effective altruism. And without that framework, the problem is that, well, how do you pick within all the space of all the problems you can, of all the methods you can have, what are your priorities? Is it to maximize your cost effectiveness? Is it to get a small chance at the huge systemic impact? Is it financial sustainability? And so when we talk about maximizing impact, what is it that we are actually maximizing? And I like to think of it in terms of what I call the impact equation. So at the end of the day, what we're doing is very simple. We're just looking at some function of resources committed. And in the simplest form, it just says impact equals dollars raised times impact per dollar. And so if we look at the Anti-Malaria Foundation, this is essentially what Givewell's argument is reframed. Because we have all this amazing research on the effectiveness, we know that the error bars are pretty tight. And we also know the slope is really good, $3,500 per life saved. That's amazing. And so it seems pretty simple to compare charity one versus charity two. Well, just pick the one that has the highest slope. So in that scenario, if you want to compare charities that have a per unit impact, one way to look at it is just you compute the first derivative of the impact equation. So that means that if you want to optimize your portfolio, the way that you have the optimal impact is actually pretty simple. You just try to pick the nonprofit with the highest multiplier, and you just try to dump as much money as possible into it until it saturates. For example, by promoting it in some website to rank top charities. So, well, problem solved? Not really. This is just one type of organization, and while it's great, there are many other types of impact that you can have, and the risk that we run is to focus a little bit too much on linear models of impact, and you have many others like research or political action. For example, if you take MIRI, well, what's the ROI on a line of code? Well, I don't know, and that's not the right question to ask because they don't have the same impact equation. And so how do you choose the impact equation? Let's take the AMF example again, but this time looking at the total problem size. So here, it's 800,000 lives a year to malaria. And obviously, this is super, super simplified given the format of this talk. But if you could somehow scale AMF's impact all the way to the top right, you'd need around $3 billion. You know, it sounds fantastic. But if you look at AI research, well, this is a big tongue-in-cheek, but if you had to create a nonprofit to rebuild the world after the AI apocalypse through targeted interventions, well, you can have the most cost-efficient interventions in the world, you can have all the money in the world, but you're never going to make a dent in the actual problem. So instead, what you want to do is to invest in other forms of impact, like artificial intelligence safety research. And here, so the cover's a little bit messed up, I think the translation is a bit weird, but essentially, what you have here is you have a curve that is going to overtake the linear impact at some point, and maybe it will take you $100 million to get anything done. And until that happens, you'll look at like a total lunatic that just wasted his money donating to AI research. But once you cross that point, well, you'll see that you actually have a more fitting solution to the actual problem because you have the solution that actually compounds, like the knowledge here compounds, and so the second derivative of your impact equation is positive. And so what you have to do is to look at the total problem size, and if it's too big, or if you expect that the curves will cross before you succeed at solving the problem, then maybe you want to find a source of impact that can compound and that does not require you to raise increasingly large amounts of money to scale. And it's not that clear-cut, obviously. So in the case of malaria, will AMF's mosquito-net approach be ultimately more efficient than Gates' search for a cure for malaria? Well, that's a multi-billion-dollar question. But what remains is that if you want to solve societal issues or existential risks, the maximal impact function tends to look a bit more like research or software or political action. And for example, here at Bayes Impact, what we're doing is we are a nonprofit that is trying to change the world by optimizing social services through algorithms. And here, the real value add is not just through any specific project, but it really is the learning process and how we can, over time, crack the formula for working with difficult organizations like governments. That's the real kicker. And it's not so much about what we know today, but about what is left to learn for us in the future. And what can get us through the hump is precisely the ability to generate revenue along the way through projects. So to recap, impact equals dollars raised times impact per dollar. And so depending on the size of the problem and the pros that you choose, you kind of have two options. Either you take the multiplier as fixed, and then you try to maximize for fundraising, or you can do it the other way around and try to find an approach that can compound over time and fix the amount that you need, so some amount of fixed investment that is necessary to then grow your impact over time. Thank you.
Thank you. Man, 5-minute talks are hard. There's so much information I know that y'all have to share. So thank you all for being awesome troopers about it. Ozzy? Yes. And how do you pronounce your last name? I'm curious. Gouin. Yes. Here you go.
Thank you so much. Can I start over here? Hi, everyone. Okay, so my name is Ozzy, and I've been working a bit for the last year and a half to produce Dot Impact. Dot Impact is a collective of people working on producing EA projects. And I think this is important because we haven't really yet optimized the nights and weekends of the effective altruists. Like, we've optimized, like, the weekdays, but they still have, like, 40 hours left, and this seems like a huge opportunity. Maybe not exactly 40 hours, but quite a bit. So we've been playing with, like, optimizing those hours and seeing what we could do in that time. We're a bunch of typically web people, so if it's websites, but we've done other stuff as well, and we want all of you guys to join in with your EA projects, so just let us know what you're doing so we could help build a community together. Okay. So I want to point out Patrick, he's over there. He is this guy. He made Skillshare.im. Skillshare.im was about a year ago. We had the idea of making a platform for EAs to share and give each other stuff for free, because we all have the same kinds of goals. So it kind of makes sense that we could be okay exchanging things. So we've published it. I encourage all of you guys to check it out. Share free stuff, get free stuff. If you want to take a road trip of the US or a road trip around the world and stay with EAs in the process, this site will help you find lodging in a lot of those places. Or if you just want, like, other cool advice and stuff, this is a good place for that. Effective Altruist Hub. Raise your hands if you guys have seen this online or checked it out. Great. If you're not on it yet, go on it. This was made by Tom Ash, who really spearheaded this. It's a community, so you could see all of the other EAs, like a social network of EAs. And not only does it have the people, but it also has the clubs. So we've been going around trying to figure out where all of the EA organizations are around the world. And there are a lot that we didn't know about. There are over 100. I mean, you could see 64 in this area. There's like India, Vietnam, Malaysia. It's like quite a few. So if you just want to, like, are interested in seeing what's going on, I think it's a cool resource. We also have a bunch of programs in this. So this is Shop for Charity. How many of you guys buy stuff on Amazon? Yeah, so you may want 5% of that to go to SCI or some other awesome nonprofit. Do this, you get 5% or more back. It's very easy and a very quick win. So this is the EA forum. So lots of you guys have probably seen this. If you haven't, definitely check it out. This is where all the EA writing is happening now, or at least a lot of it. A lot of it's still in private blogs. It does need a lot of maintenance, though. So we've been working on maintaining the forum. Also, if you have features that you want to add, if there are things that you think could be improved, let us know, put it on there. And if you want to use your nights and weekends to make it awesome and just, like, add functionality, just come on the GitHub page, add stuff, would be super happy. Next, 2014 survey. So maybe 1,000 people are going to this conference now. That's awesome, but we were kind of curious who was exposed to effective altruism. Like, how many people were in the EA movement? What were they like? The rationalist survey was posted on Less Wrong, and that's done a very good job. We wanted to do one for effective altruism. So we got about 2,500 people responding to this survey of about 40 questions, and then we posted all the responses online. So you could go through the data, and in addition, there's a few pages of PDFs of, like, interesting insights, although I'm sure for you guys, you may be used to it by now, about effective altruists. Next. Great. So Howard was a high school student who actually came up to us with one awesome project idea. But it was probably a bit too ambitious at that point. So we tried to get something, like, very straightforward that he would easily be able to do. That was also, like, a really interesting thing that we could get a lot of people onto. Wikipedia isn't known for accepting all kinds of content. It's great, but there's a lot of stuff that we can't really get on there. So it was really nice to have an effective altruist wiki just for all, like absolutely everything in effective altruism that people want to know or people think that other people should know. This is it. I also recommend checking that out as well. This is kind of cool. This is Sam playing around with the idea of like, what if you have 3 hours and you want to do something effective altruist for 3 hours? Or what if you have 15 minutes and you just want to do like a cool thing in 15 minutes? This is an app that has like a spreadsheet of all the tasks that people have thought about for like any period of time. And it even comes with like pointing system. So you could just say, I have an hour open and it'll just like give you something and then you could reject it and say, no, I want to do something else. And it gives you points depending on how many things you complete. So that's a fun one. So those are the projects. Those are a few of the things that were published. A lot more has come out of that too. I suggest checking out the projects page. But the other question is like, how are we doing it? What infrastructure do we have? And for that, we're encouraging and coordinating EA projects, and we have infrastructure and events. For infrastructure, back to people. Mess up my slides. Can you guys raise up your hands if you've on the slide or a part of .impact, or you've come to a .impact event? I'm looking at you. Talk to these people if you have any questions about .impact. People were all over, and we did this online, so we were able to get community that was international. A lot of people, just in some remote town or some place, and it was nice to be able to get them involved and make sure everyone's on the same page. We have a Slack group, so this is like a place for everyone to share ideas. If someone has a document that they want other EAs to edit, just like post it there. We have events, so we're giving presentations that are live. You could see them on YouTube. And more recently, we have workathons. So these are pretty awesome. 4 hours every Sunday, 12 to 4, international. In the beginning, we go around, we say what we're going to do in that 4 hours. In the end, we say what we've done in those 4 hours. Those parts are online, they're for anyone to see. We document the work that gets done, and all of it's basically on EA projects and cool stuff like that. If you have an EA project, we suggest you join. We've had 4 of them so far. Should have showed you that slide right before. But basically, workathons, Sundays, 12 to 4 Pacific. You come, and we'll give you work. So that's .impact. If any of you, I think one thing that I wasn't originally thinking about is that I think a lot of the people here have awesome projects that they're doing and they already are confident in. We have people who are trying to find awesome projects to be contributing to and are trying to help out. So if you think that you could take volunteers or if you just want to get more people in the community involved, like come to us, come to the workathons, come to those things, and it'd be awesome to encourage those connections. Thank you.
Awesome. So we just have a few-ish more. So Christian Rune, is Christian here? Yes. Very mysterious of you. Moment of suspense. All right. And Christian is with Normative, is that correct?
Yeah, that is indeed correct. Yeah, sure. Let's do that. Let's make it a bit harder. So tell me. Okay. So hi, everyone. I'm Christian, and together with Robin here, I am the founder of Normative. And Normative is basically an app for ethical impact spending analysis. And in this presentation, I will tell you more about it. So I'm a huge quantified self fan, but what if instead of improving myself, I would like to find ways to improve the world? I mean, there's got to be an app for that. And that's how the idea for Normative was born. So basically, Normative is an impact factor database containing the marginal impact of different spending categories. Like, for example, the impact from spending $1 on malaria nets, for example, in quality-adjusted life years. Or the CO2 emission from spending 1 kilo on clothes. And in total, Normative has a taxonomy that contains roughly 50,000 such spending categories and 300 different impact variables. And this is what it looks like. So you start up on the top layer of the taxonomy with a view of the world where you can select different countries. And the aggregate impact of those countries, that country is then displayed. If you want to narrow down your search more, you can choose the economical sector of that country, like, say, the agricultural sector. And if you want to narrow it down even more, you can choose a subsector, like the meat sector, for example. And on the bottom layer, normative has products, services, and health interventions. But what if you want to compare one of those, many of those 300 variables between each other? For that purpose, we have built an impact model. And what the impact model basically does is that it takes one of those variables as an input and calculates through characterization factors the quality-adjusted life year or animals killed or biodiversity from that. So, I mean, in the end, a lot of the impacts will probably be wrong or faulty. And the reason... Well, for that reason, we make the data entirely open where everyone can assess it and critique it, kind of like a wiki. So the impact queries we can do right now through our API is to send in bank transaction, product categories, health interventions, and also barcodes. And it will compute an impact array with different impacts from those inputs. And using the API, we have created an app that kind of brings it all together called Get Normative for Android. So you start by logging in, and to know more about your purchasing habits, you can connect your internet bank to Normative. And from that, it will compute your impact in different categories that you can browse if you look here. So you will see the impact from certain spendings. Then if you press on a spending category, you can also see the impact of individual transactions in, for example, carbon dioxide or quality-adjusted life years. All of that data is then aggregated into an impact screen where you will see your total impact during a month. And based on that, Normative also automatically generates a set of challenges that is kind of the lowest hanging fruit, depending on your spending patterns for making the world a better place. And those could be like, for example, becoming a vegan or donating more to charity. And it will also give you points and badges on the way. And you can also invite a friend to take the challenges with you. And I would like to end with this quote, that those attempting to guide the economy and our society are like a pilot trying to steer without a reliable compass. And we think that that is very true. And we think that Normative can at least be a humble start to have such a compass in your pocket and see the impact of everything you do. And we think that this could potentially be huge for corporate governance and also for like individuals that just want to know more about their spending. So right now, we're actually a team of 8 people building this app in Sweden, and we're soon going to start to test a minimal viable product on it, but we're soon running out of funding, and so if any one of you represent like a funding agency or a visionary philanthropist, please speak to me afterwards. And or if you want to volunteer or know more and contribute to our database, it would be awesome to talk to you all guys. And if you want to see a prototype of the app, that's like that would be awesome. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you, Christian. Next, we have Luke Nosak, who's a partner at Founders Fund.
Thank you. I'm just subscribed to the PowerPoint corrupts philosophy. So, and thank you, Christian, for your talk right beforehand. It leads right into some stuff I want to light up about the effective altruism, which is why EA could be bad for you and maybe even I don't say it's not going to destroy the world. I mean, we're all here. I'm here, standing on this stage, The first point is actually, how do we know what is a good human life for someone else? How do we measure that? How do we know that? And so I'd like to ask the crowd, I'd like to ask all of you, how many of you are currently living your vision of the perfectly happy life that you have envisioned with perfect relationships and your finances and resources for what you want to do and your relationships with all your friends and parents and everyone and that you want for your own life. Raise your hands if you have that right now. Okay, I thought it was going to be 10% of people that would lie, but it's only a smaller number. So many of us haven't figured out what a good life is. I think it's a philosophical challenge. And it's also a huge practical challenge for us as human beings. And we are trying an effective altruism, at least from most of the philosophies that we speak about here, to bring about a very good life for billions of people out on this earth. And there's a simple retort to this, which is that, well, oh my God, there's some people that just basically don't have food, that things are just really obviously horrible and things are obviously better for us. But I think there's some interesting counterexamples to that, such as the research on the country of Bhutan, which is much poorer than many of the Western countries. Their level of satisfaction with their lives is much higher. And recently, people have actually been trying to study that and figure that out. While they're already ahead of us and they're figuring out how to quantify and create a gross national happiness index. In the West, we are having our own issues. So the second thing that I think is I've seen personally in the EA movement is we try to focus on causes that are going to be rationally the most effective, that have the best evidence for them, as opposed to the ones that we're passionate about. But I would ask you to think that maybe there's some wisdom in this idea of what you're passionate about. Maybe there's something in your psyche that's actually has a very important truth. And if you were to just, and I've actually seen people do this, they go off and pursue these, you're inspired by the EA, they go pursue things that are, this is the best thing to do for the world, I'm going to do X. But it's not the thing that they kind of want to do in their gut. It's like ripping out your entire motivation structure, not replacing it with anything else. So I think, again, it's really good that we've had these thoughts about what's philosophically the best thing to do, how we calculate the impact on future lives. But if we do that and not also connect that with our own passions, I think we lose a lot of our ability to motivate ourselves and motivate those around us. Finally, in this one, is whether you're going to actually distract yourself from the hardest job that you have, which is living your own lives. And I also know this from personal experience from many people here, but particularly with myself, that the periods in my life when I wanted to go pursue the causes to benefit everybody else were the times that in my life I hadn't had my own stuff figured out. And there's something about this, you know, we can't get too much into what causes this, but I think it's a certain draw that that causes us to focus externally when there are actually internally things to figure out about our own effectiveness, about our own relationships, or about our own happiness. And for those of you, if this kind of rings a little bit true, like, maybe there's some stuff, but I'll get that later because those other people are so much more important, please, for your own sake, figure this stuff out, because it's only the costs are only going to compound like credit card debt if your own health or your own emotional health is something you're not tending to for these other causes. And also, please do it for our sake, because you're going to get in our way and in all of the important work that in people and organizations that are being effective and do have their stuff figured out that are trying to be effectively altruistic. So again, these are the reasons I like to put a warning on there for the EA label. First of all, that it's something where we want to try to have direct knowledge of happiness and understand it ourselves before we prefer to, you know, export it to others. And also that we value those internal motivation structures for ourselves and not throw them away automatically, which come from our gut. And while integrating that new knowledge, and finally figuring out our own lives first before we start figuring out things for everybody else. So thanks, everybody, and glad to be here at the EA conference with all of you.
Thank you, Luke. So we just have a couple more things that we're fitting in before break. And so Alan Fenwick with SEI. Did I get your last name right? Okay. All right. Excellent. Fenwick.
Pronounce it a couple of ways, but I like either one. So it was wonderful what that gentleman has just said, because a lot of you know about SCI, and you know that GiveWell recommend us because of our effectiveness and our cost effectiveness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I want to tell you now is why I do it, which is the passion. So if you, I'll just point you, give me the next slide, and I'll race through them as fast as I can. So these are neglected tropical diseases. Everybody knows about malaria and HIV and TB, and hundreds of people work on them. These are all neglected. I work on them. I lecture on them because I'm the only person who can spell them and can pronounce them. Next one. And there are consequences of these neglected tropical diseases that people don't know anything about. And I'm going to jump to the next one because this is a photo I took in Niger. These three kids are three out of all the children in the school, and 90% of the children in the school were passing urine that color. Next one. This is a guy in Uganda who was full of schistosomiasis. He's 22 years old, and he's going to die within 3 months because his liver is completely shot. Effectiveness, yes. Passion. I've seen cases like this, and this is why I work on schistosomiasis. Next one. What we've found recently is not only are older people getting infected, but preschool-age children are getting infected. Next slide. Because women are taking, that's a good slide. Women are taking their children to the rivers when they're washing their clothes, and they're sitting them in a bowl of water to cool them down, and they're getting infected with this disease. We have jumped quite a lot of slides that I wanted to show you, but this is how we actually deliver the drugs. A lot of people say to me, how do you deliver the drugs? We deliver them very easily. We line up school children, and we stand them against a pole, which doesn't say you're 2 meters in height. It says you're 2 tablets high. And then we have a person here with a pile of tablets in the next slide, if it hasn't jumped. Yes, it has. So we are testing children in school. Sorry, these slides are just not quite where. This is the one I wanted. So there we go. We've got all these kids lined up. It only has to be done once a day, once a year, and it can all be done in one day. And we jump from school to school to school. In fact, in a country, it can all be done on the same day by teachers who've been trained. It's simple logistics that we do. That's why it's so effective. Next one. And the effect is incredible. We have to be proactive and go out because these kids are never going to seek out the drugs that they need. But this is a child who is stunted. And the little red line shows you that if we can give these kids one tablet at the age of 6, 7, and 8, they will have a growth spurt, but there's a point of no return. We've got to get there quickly, and we've got to deworm the children in order to get that effect. The next slide is even more poignant. This is the same child 30 days after being dewormed. On the left, a stomach full of worms. On the right, ready to run a marathon. Next one. These are the numbers of people who are infected with schistosomiasis who need treatment. This is just the top 12 countries. There are 200 million kids and adults in Africa, 25% of the population, who are infected with a disease which is totally neglected. Next. And this is what we'll do if we can get a bit of extra money. This is actually the amount of money that we've got we've got guaranteed for us, and the number of treatments that we can give. At the moment, we are treating, I say we, it's the Ministries of Health and Education who are doing it. In 16 countries, we're treating 40 million children every year, and we need to double it. Why do we need to double it? We need to double it because in the last year, we've persuaded the pharmaceutical company that manufactures the drug that previously I was buying to donate it. This year, they've donated 100 million tablets of this drug, and as a result, we've been able to treat 40 million children. Next year, they've agreed to double the amount of drugs that they're going to give us, enough to treat 100 million children, and that's why we need this extra funding so that we can deliver it. What I've wanted in this last 30 seconds is to tell you I do it because I'm passionate about it. And if I could take you to Africa and show you the children before and after, you would all donate your 50 pence or 50 cents to SCI. Thank you.
So for our final community talk, we have Aditya Prasad, who is with Google, and this is a personal project, I believe, that he is working on. Non-official Google. So the technology will work. Is what that means.
So I think the most effective way to save the world, sorry, I'm reading off this, the most effective way to save the world is to awaken the hearts of a lot of people so that they want to save the world. And you might think that people already want to save the world because if you ask them, they say yes. But almost none of them make it a priority, as you know. Data is often not enough to change people's priorities. This slide is bad. You need to reach something much more primal in people. So I wanted to share some of the research around that. Next slide, please. So under certain contrived circumstances, 1 in 6 people give up their seat for a stranger on crutches. But people who are taught just a few hours of basic mindfulness give up their seats much more often, at a rate of 3 in 6. Now, why does just sitting there cause people to become kinder? Well, the jury is still out, but my personal favorite answer is that I already know the right thing to do. Mindful awareness just brings it to the surface. Now, this is profound. Simply becoming powerfully aware of your own values is often enough to bring your behavior into alignment. And this can happen at random moments in life. For example, during near-death experiences, people often reflect and radically adjust their lifestyles. But it's not cool to induce near-death experiences. So, is there anything we can do? So listen to some quotes and that I'll be explaining. I said to myself, I am love, and all I ever want to be is love. I was aware of tears flooding my eyes. All the other goals in life seemed completely stupid. It has torn my heart open and revealed how my actions affect other people in ways I would have never imagined. It has increased my ability to empathize to a degree I never thought possible. These subjects took psilocybin, the active ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms. It's been super illegal since 1968, making it impossible to study until now. Here's some recent research. Quote, this is one of the first studies to show that you can actually change adult personality. She means in a positive way. The very idea of personality being immutable is being questioned. Oops, we skipped a couple. The fact that a drug given once can have such an effect for so long is an unprecedented finding. We have never had anything like it in the psychiatric field. But how safe is it? But how safe is it? Well, it has the lowest risk of overdose and the lowest dependence potential of any known drug. Caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol are up there in the upper right. Next slide. So this huge study found no significant associations between usage of psilocybin and increased risks of anxiety, depression, psychosis, or any of the other negative outcomes studied. And this study showed that lifetime use of psilocybin correlated with significantly decreased rates of depression and suicidality, contrary to every other drug class. Now, a large majority of subjects call it one of the 5 most meaningful experiences of their lives. All of them rated it as at least the most meaningful of a given year. And if you ask their loved ones 14 months later how they've changed, you'll find that they've become kinder, more open, more patient, based on this composite index. This is after 1 dose. So I'm not suggesting that we tell everyone to run off and eat shrooms and run naked through the woods. But we do know now enough about the medical usage to bring about the positive effects and mitigate the negative ones. So to recap, there are precious few ways to help people come to the realization that they want to improve the world or bring good to the world, even though they probably do. Our goal of saving the world, I think, depends on having more allies rather than just a few. So otherwise, our solutions are just Band-Aids, and I think we're putting off the real issue. So I think we should invest more time in this kind of research and putting it into practice. Thank you.